I knew it had to happen some week, but I sadly report to you this morning the first vandalism we have had since we have been in this building. We have two BB holes in the window over by the piano, which we did not have a couple of days ago. No one present this morning, including myself, will ever have heard a communion meditation quite like the one I'm about to offer. But I hope the difference will be helpful in some way as we celebrate worldwide communion. I realize that a familiar approach is always comfortable, but something different can be provocative and a way of seeing things in a new light. I'm simply trying to be open and honest about my offbeat approach, because that's how my grandson was the other day with me. He has to spend a while with me sometimes before he goes on to kindergarten. And on this particular day, as I went about my work, he asked still another in a never-ending series of questions. He said, "Why are you doing that?" In a tone of voice that implied it was a very odd thing for me to do. I had given about all the answers I had in me for one day. So I said, "Oh, I'm just a little strange, I guess." To which, without missing a beat, he delivered his own sober judgment on my personality. He said, "A lot strange." So this strange man who loves him and preaches to you is going to approach communion in a strange, roundabout way. First, I want you to think about how we know things. How some things register in the mind as fact, and how other things register in the heart and become part of our emotional landscape. I was in the study last week at the typewriter, and I had just written a notice for this morning's bulletin in which I listed the sermons for the month under the title Oktoberfest. It wasn't a premeditated choice. It just popped onto the page under my fingers, and it certainly wasn't important. But suddenly, for no very good or essential reason, I wanted to stop and refresh my memory about the details of that great German festival. So I reached for the closest source book, which was the big unabridged dictionary at my elbow. And as my eyes ran down the page to find O-K-T-O, I came across the word Oki. Now, you might not have felt any compulsion to stop and read the definition, but I grew up in Oklahoma. And the guy from Chicago who married my sister called her with great affection all their days together by the nickname Oki. So I wanted to check my emotional response to that word against the kind of factual knowledge that goes into the dictionary. I discovered that one meaning is an insulting name for people who live on the Japanese island of Okinawa, which was news to me, and that the other meaning of Oki was a migrant worker from Oklahoma. My head told me that the definition was a little wrong to begin with, because although the Okies took their name from Oklahoma, they did not all originate in that state. They came from Arkansas and Texas, and they picked up fellow travelers in New Mexico and Arizona, and there were even a few families who dropped down to join the party from southern Kansas. But that's information that runs around inside the head. If you want the other kind of knowledge, the kind that touches the heart, then you have to have known those people and their terrible distress, or failing that, you have to read with a keen and lively imagination one of the best of American novels, John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. Identify with Ma Jode, that marvelous woman of indomitable strength, and with her son Tom, who finds a purpose in life, and with Jim Casey, the preacher, who grows into a great man before our eyes. Identify with those characters and with others in the novel, and the word Okey will never again mean the same thing. You will have heart knowledge. Now, you may have forgotten how we got where we are right now, but I am up in the study looking at the dictionary, trying to find the word Oktoberfest, and I've gotten stopped by the word Okey and by some reflections that came to me then about the different ways we know things. But the bulletin is still waiting, so I move on to the word I wanted in the first place, only to find that there isn't enough information. I get up and go downstairs to other shelves of books and pull out Thomas Wolfe's The Web and the Rock so that I can reread the chapter where he tells what the famous autumn fair in Munich is like. He makes me smell the hall packed with overweight bodies and hear the sullen roar of the crowd, which almost frightened him, and taste the dark, bitter October beer. But I still want more information about how it all got started. So I go into the living room where the 24 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica rest in dark blue dignity, and open the one that will have entries under OK. And all of a sudden, my eyes fall on the name of a small town called Okmulgee, Oklahoma. That town never even got itself into the World Book, published in America. So it seems odd to see the name of my little hometown, my birthplace, in that awesome collection of serious and solemn fact. So while the bulletin waits some more, I read eagerly the paragraph about Okmulgee. Straight facts. A city of eastern Oklahoma, USA, on Federal Highway 75 and the Frisco and Okmulgee Northern Railways. Population 1920, 17,430. Parenthesis, 78% white and 19% Negroes. They had not learned to say blacks then. I came along a little later, but the town didn't grow. And of the time when I was in high school, Britannica says it is the center of one of the great oil-producing regions of the world. Within an area of 2,000 square miles are some 6,000 producing wells, which supply 16% of the total output of the United States. Facts. I grew up seeing those wells, but we didn't own one. And the knowledge never really touched my emotional life. But when Britannica went on to talk about the refineries, All of a sudden, I could smell old Phillips 66, which was never completely out of anybody's mind in Okmulgee, since so many fathers and sons worked there, and since the danger of another fatal explosion was something we lived with every day. And standing down there in the living room by the bookcase, I could see and smell, all of a sudden, a little stream we called Greasy Creek, which I passed every day on the way to school, marveling at the rainbow of iridescence from the oil it carried through the town. The fact that the refineries made 200,000 gallons of gasoline every day didn't do much for me. But my childhood awe of that strange place and the remembered smells and a sudden image in my mind of a man named Jimmy Bissett who played for the old Phillips 66ers and who was the most skillful hitter and the most graceful outfielder I had ever seen. All of these memories brought back my adolescence and my friends and my family. Knowledge of the heart. And especially when I read the final entry. In a square in the heart of the city stands the council house, which was the capital of the Creek Indian Nation for half a century. Just a bare statement of fact, but transformed by my memory into bits and pieces of my life. I remember the square. On Saturdays, before the movie started, I would roam the Creek Indian Museum, where I first got acquainted with arrowheads and pottery, beaded deer skin and moccasins. I see the words of dry fact on the pages of Britannica, but my nose wrinkles and I can smell those musty old rooms. And on Saturday nights, through the long Oklahoma summer, while my dad kept his furniture store open, my sister and I would play in that square with other kids whose fathers were businessmen too and kept their stores open. And by now, the knowledge of the heart begins to strike deeper, because I see my sister again, who made an exit from this life too soon, and I can hear her voice, and as if it were on a clear screen before me, I relive the Saturday night when she did not see a piece of barbed wire some workmen had left, did not notice in time this sister who could run like the wind, and tore open her arm so that the rest of her life there was a big ugly scar to link the two of us with that night and being together and our happy childhood. A few lines of neutral fact in the encyclopedia, and by an act of imagination, my own life passes again before my eyes. Let's relate it now to what we are doing this morning. You can go downstairs to the library, pick up the appropriate volume of the Interpreter's Bible Dictionary, and read a long theological essay about the Lord's Supper. You can catalog more facts than I would ever wish to unload in a single sermon. But facts only make a difference to character when they slip from the head to the heart. Is it possible to make that happen with communion before we take it together? Let's try. Go behind the words that Matthew read so well to you from Luke a few minutes ago and imagine a desperately tired man and a few of his friends climbing the stairs to an upper room in Jerusalem to eat a simple meal by candlelight. A crusty loaf of bread, a goatskin bag full of cheap wine. There is tension in the room, fear of the unknown, a brooding sense that something dear to all of them is coming to an end. Somewhere in a Roman barracks, a young soldier is finding it hard to sleep because he keeps seeing the agonies of crucifixion which he will have to inflict in the morning. And inside the room there is a little clink of silver in the pocket of Judas when he moves and a look on the face of Jesus which his friends had not seen before. And then he picks up a piece of bread, looks at it thoughtfully, and says, "This is my body broken for you." And they eat it, understanding a little of what he means. And they drink the dark red wine, which looks a little like the blood which he will spill in a few hours. And afterwards the soldiers come to arrest their friend, and the fatal kiss is given, the cock crows, and in the morning the cross on the hill carries its new burden. A few days later, two of the disciples walk along a dusty road to a little town called Emmaus. A stranger joins them, and they talk of odd rumors flying about. And as evening falls, they invite the stranger to join them for supper. As they eat, he takes a loaf, blesses it, and breaks it, and their eyes, we are told, are opened. "It is he," they say, and then he is gone. If it comforts you to take that story literally, then by all means do so. I see it as one of the most beautiful little parables ever put together. A way of saying to us that wherever we are, thinking of him, and in his name serving others, he will be among us. Even in so simple a thing as breaking bread, done with love and hopefulness, he is present. We see him not with the eyes that read a book, but with the eyes of the heart. In a moment, we try to feel what it was like on that last night when God's child looked at the broken bread and the wine and found in them the symbols of his love. Be thankful, beloved friends, for the gift of memory, and even more for the gift of imagination. And use them both in whatever ways will help you. Amen.